Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the executive order Donald Trump signed today to roll back the Clean Water Rule as a first step to dismantle EPA protections enacted by President Obama. Winona Horta, the author of Foodopoly, The Battle Over the Future of Food and Farming in America, and the executive director of Food and Water Watch, joins us from across the street from the White House in Lafayette Square, where she has organized a demonstration along with Bernie Sanders, Our Revolution, and a diverse group of activists in what they are calling a resistance address, defending American values in a time of moral crisis. We'll discuss Trump's plan to cut the $8 billion budget of the EPA down to $6 billion as a way to offset a $54 billion increase in defense spending, upping the Pentagon's budget to $603 billion a year, with the additional amount of $54 billion being the equivalent of the entire amount of what Russia spends on defense per year. Then we'll assess Donald Trump's upcoming State of the Union address with John Storr, a lecturer in political science at Yale University and a contributing editor at U.S. News & World Report, where he has an article, Trump Can't Govern. The Democrats' best play might be to highlight the Trump administration's incompetence. We will discuss his idea that rather than expose Trump's white nationalist sympathies and express alarm at the rise of fascism in America, the best way forward for the growing opposition may be to stress what is abundantly clear, Trump can't govern. Then finally, we will speak with Robert Young Pelton, an author, filmmaker, journalist, and explorer who has been on a number of special forces raids in Afghanistan and Iraq. He joins us to discuss the call for an investigation into the recent raid in Yemen by the father of the SEAL, Ryan Owens, who died in the raid, and Donald Trump's remark on Fox News this morning where he passed the buck, saying, quote, "They examined what they wanted to do, the generals, who are very respected. My generals are the most respected we've had in many decades, I believe. And they lost Ryan." We will also look into the real possibility that the Trump administration will launch a war against Iran. And before we begin, I'd like to invite you to the Issue and a Hammer Forum that I'm moderating tomorrow night, Wednesday, March the 1st at 7:30 p.m. We'll be looking into the largest Native American protest in history against the Dakota Access Pipeline with UCLA law professors Carol Goldberg and Angela Riley, along with scholar and activist Melanie Yazzi. Again, tomorrow night, March the 1st at 7:30 p.m. at the UCLA Hammer Forum in Westwood, standing tall for tribal rights. Join me, free and open to the public. And joining us from Lafayette Park, across from the White House, is Winona Horta, who's the author of Foodopoly, The Battle Over the Future of Food and Farming in America. She's the executive director of Food and Water Watch. Welcome to Background Briefing, Winona Horta.
Hi, I'm so glad to be here.
Well, thank you, Winona. And Donald Trump signed an executive order today to start undoing the Clean Water Act. It's sort of easier said than done. I don't want to give our audience false hopes because it's obviously an attack on anything that Obama did in terms of EPA protections. But I take it that you're there in front of the White House to let President Trump know that people in this country actually want clean water, which you would think would be a no-brainer.
Yes, we're here with a wide array of groups this evening to tell Donald Trump that the narrative he's putting out, the agenda he's putting out in his address to the joint sessions of Congress, is not one that most Americans agree with. And in fact, what he is doing potentially to safe drinking water is just one of the issues where he's actually hurting the people that he claims to defend. And we expect this evening to see a very discriminatory agenda put out that undermines equality and our shared values, and that is devastating for the environment. And we're here to say that together the progressive movement is going to resist, protect, and rebuild.
Well, on top of signing this new executive order today, Donald Trump is asking the new EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt to begin this long process of repealing the Clean Water Rule. He's also, just yesterday, in the budget that was announced, a $54 billion increase in the defense budget. And by the way, it's worth noting, Winona, that $54 billion increase in the U.S. defense budget from, you know, which brings it up to $603 billion, that $54 billion is the equivalent to the entire Russian defense budget per year. So we're increasing our defense by the entire amount that Russia pays, just to give us some context. But to offset this raise, he wants to cut from the EPA, whose budget is only $8 billion, and the State Department, which is only $50 billion. So is he going to decimate the EPA?
Oh, absolutely. Right now, the figures that we're seeing are about $6 billion that the EPA budget would be, and that's a $2 billion cut. And this means a lot of very common sense programs. One out of five EPA employees would be fired. And this is just the tip of the iceberg the first year. So we expect to see a lot of attacks on different aspects of the Environmental Protection Agency. And we're going to be out in the states asking senators and other elected officials in the House to stand up to the Trump agenda. And if they don't, there is going to be, they are going to suffer defeats in the 2018 election, because most people believe in safe drinking water.
Well, we saw what happened with Flint, and it's still that situation's not resolved. But it certainly got the attention of the nation, and the idea that young kids' lives are ruined because of lead poisoning is just appalling to think that that's happening in America today. But what about the Republicans themselves in terms of the history of the Republican Party? First of all, Theodore Roosevelt, the Republican president, he in effect started the environmental movement, and then the EPA itself was founded under President Nixon. So are there traditional Republicans that you can work with that would presumably be appalled at the idea that safeguards that prevent Americans from getting poisoned from the water, like the kids in Flint, Michigan, will be lifted and it'll be a free-for-all?
Well, what we're going to have to do is organize in the congressional districts where people can tell their elected representatives, Republican and Democrat, that they don't want these budget cuts, that they want safe water, and that they don't agree with this. And in fact, Food and Water Watch has crunched some numbers, and we find that the $25 billion that Trump wants to spend on the wall would actually fix five out of six lead service pipes around the country, affecting up to 22 million American homes and protecting children. And we'd say that's real homeland security, protecting future generations from lead poisoning.
Well, I thank you for your time, and I wish you well tonight in drawing attention to what President Trump is doing. And it's pretty hard to understand why he's doing it. And is it the Koch brothers? Just in closing, do you know who it is that's setting this?
Well, I think it's a large number of billionaire supporters, including the Koch brothers. But I think there are some members of Trump's advisory team, like Bannon, who have a very dark vision for the future. And I think it's one that most Americans don't support.
Thank you.
Okay, great.
Bye-bye. And again, I've been speaking with Winona Horder, who is the author of Foodopoly, The Battle Over the Future of Food and Farming in America. She's the executive director of Food and Water Watch, and she joined us from Lafayette Park across from the White House, where she is leading a demonstration that includes a large number of activists who are protesting in conjunction with President Trump's State of the Union address tonight. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back assessing Donald Trump's upcoming State of the Union address.
Oceans, rivers, lakes, and streams have all been touched by man. Poison floating out to sea, now threatening.
say what's happened to the water. It's going back.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is John Storr, who's a lecturer in political science at Yale, a business columnist for Hearst Newspapers, an essayist for the New Haven Register, and a U.S. News and World Report contributing editor, where he has an article, Trump Can't Govern. The Democrats' best play might be to highlight the Trump administration's incompetence. Welcome to Background Briefing, John Storr.
Thank you so much.
And it does feel like in many ways the country's trapped with this dangerous and incompetent president. And in many ways you could argue that the people that he's enabled, the vice president and the Republican heads of the House and Senate, Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell, and the cabinet that he's put in, they're hitting the ground running. Some have argued that the chaos and incompetence in the White House may actually be in some ways limiting the aggressive agenda of those that Trump has empowered and enabled.
Meaning, yeah.
So how do you feel about that? So I know it's a cynical notion, but what's your
well,
go ahead.
Well, what's more cynical is another working theory about the chaos, and that is that the chaos is purposeful, that Steve Bannon and Stephen Miller and other insiders are trying to be disruptive in order to shake up the establishment and pave the way for fascism. That's one of the more cynical theories that I've heard. And that's part of that was one of the things I had in mind when I wrote my piece. Basically, I was trying to figure out, well, you know, where does incompetence end and fascism begin? You know, are we seeing fascism when really what's just going on is plain incompetence? One certainly can beget the other, but in terms of your political strategy, I think it's important to, and especially in terms of your messaging, it's important to be cognizant of what you think the problem is and what solution you want to offer to voters whom you want to court into, you know, into the Democratic Party. So I think it's important, you know, you could say, you know, Bannon, you know, wrote the executive order limiting the number of Muslim, travelers, they say. But the Muslim ban, you know, could have been a wrecking ball. But the other thing is that he could have been just, you know, slapped together. I'm kind of a person who looks for the simplest solution to the problem first, and then maybe there's a more complex solution later. It just seems to me that Bannon in particular seems to be talking a good game about, you know, dismantling, deconstructing the administrative state. But when it comes to actually doing that, I'm not sure he's got it all together.
Well, of course, there is an inherent contradiction between having the trains run on time, which was the famous Mussolini claim and apology, in effect, and the kind of incompetence we're talking about. If they're fascists and they're incompetent fascists, that's almost an oxymoron. But the one thing that all the people I've talked to who have known Trump over the years say that he's crazy to deal with. I talked to a business guy recently who met with him at the urging of Goldman Sachs, and this was a while back. And after 5 minutes with this guy, he thought, this character's crazy. He couldn't wait to get out of the room. And you hear that more and more. And the one thing that we know about him is that he's kind of tacky, tawdry, worships sort of tawdry celebrity, or maybe they're the only people he can recruit to support him. But mm-hmm. his taste is really appalling from all that gold and marble. So maybe mm-hmm. this is just a tacky guy who's just sort of accidentally landed himself in the top job. And my mm-hmm. sense is that what might well undo him is that he is so undignified, because we have a political system where our political head is also the head of state. So we don't have mm-hmm. the queen, but we have a head of state. who's an embarrassment to an increasing number, or in fact an increasing majority of Americans.
Yeah, I think that's right. There's a there was a great piece, I don't remember now where I read it, but about the difference between a CEO of a public company and the guy who runs a private company. And the CEO of a public company is always aware of his, the accountability that he has to shareholders, to stakeholders, and if he's socially conscious, to the environment, et cetera. In other words, the buck does stop with him, and he's ultimately responsible for whatever the enterprise does. For somebody who runs a family business, all those values and principles could apply, but they don't necessarily have to apply, because this guy who runs a private business, and I've known a few in my life, mostly small businessmen, they rule their roost. They are kings of their spheres of influence, and they cannot be told that they are wrong. And if they are found to be wrong, then they will find some way of deflecting blame. And there's not really any process by which to hold that person accountable, because all the rules are written by the king of the roost. So I find that to be a fairly good way of interpreting Trump and his mannerisms. Is very impulse-driven, right? He's reactive to whatever is right in front of him. He doesn't seem to have a long-term view, because he doesn't need to have a long-term view, or hasn't had to need one as the person running a private enterprise. People come to him with proposals, and he says yes or no. And I think this kind of, I don't want to use the word narcissism, because it seems to be too much in circulation, but this kind of myopia can explain why he is so careful about who's his enemy and who are his friends. That is a very hard line for him. There's people who oppose him, and then there's people who don't. And anybody who doesn't follow a certain view that he has, is the enemy. And of course, what constitutes that particular view is not subject to any kind of objective reality. It's just whatever he says that particular day. So chaos seems to be inevitable in a situation like that, where this seems to account for why the White House cannot send a coherent message. Mike Pence says one thing, Steve Bannon says another thing, Donald Trump will contradict both of them the next day. They cannot figure out what it is he will be saying in one particular day, and because he goes from day to day, there's not much consistency. So it seems like chaos would be a natural result of that. Could that lead us down the road to authoritarianism? Yeah, I suppose, if he's unchecked. But how you send a message, particularly in the opposition with the Democratic Party, how you send a message, you probably want to focus more on the fact that he can't govern, more than you focus on the fact that he's sympathetic to white nationalists. You probably want to focus on that if your target voter is, say, an affluent, white, suburban voter on the outskirts of Philadelphia or on the outskirts of L.A., people who are probably not too receptive to the white nationalist accusations, but they would be very receptive to pointing out that the president is incompetent.
And again, I'm speaking with John Storr, who's a lecturer in political science at Yale University, a business columnist for Hearst Newspapers, an essayist for the New Haven Register, and a U.S. News and World Report contributing editor, where he has an article, Trump Can't Govern. The Democrats' best play might be to highlight the Trump administration's incompetence. When you touch, though, on the notion that he runs a privately held corporation, he's not answerable to anybody, no shareholders, operates in secret, that seems to be, in many ways, where his support's also coming from. A lot of these people he's put in, the billionaires like Wilbur Ross and Betsy DeVos, they also come out of privately held corporations. So do the Koch brothers. So does Mercer, the reclusive billionaire who runs this incredibly profitable hedge fund, who, along with his daughter, seems to have inordinate influence. They're the biggest funders of Trump in the campaign, and they're both very close to both Stephen Bannon and to the son-in-law, Jared Kushner. So is there something to that? In other words, they're running running the country like a private corporation, or at least they're trying to, but they're also, in effect, really supporting or enabling these kind of billionaires that have privately held corporations. And that's why, for example, at CPAC, Bannon went after corporate America, because he's talking about publicly held corporations who mm-hmm. are answerable to shareholders and to consumers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd like to think in terms of the fundamentals of democracy. You know, who is the sovereign? The people. The people give consent to those who govern over the people, and that person can only govern with the consent of the people. What that means is accountability and transparency. We have to know what people are doing in our name. And this is what a lot of progressives 100 years ago, this is the ammunition that progressives used 100 years ago when they attacked large corporations, especially privately held corporations, that had too much power. They could not be held accountable. In a way, the Democratic Party should approach Trump and Wilbur Ross and Betsy DeVos the way that the progressives did 100 years ago and attack them on antitrust grounds. Now, I'm mixing economics and politics here, but I think you'll get the idea that the principle is the same. You attack power that is concentrated so much that it cannot be held accountable to the people. It's concentrated so much that it has more sovereignty than the people, which means that you're not in a democracy. Right, and that should be distasteful, if not offensive, to every single American, any single American who believes that we, the people, mean something. And this is, again, this is what kind of goes back to the original theme about competence, that, you know, competence means that you know how to be transparent, that you know what it means to be accountable, and that has value, at least in the appearance. You know, at least you give lip service to it. You know, you know Richard Nixon didn't believe in it, but he at least gave lip service all the way up to when he left. So that kind of competence is not there. I mean, it's getting so bad now. I know you're running out of time, but it's getting so bad now with Trump that he's actually suggesting today that the waves of anti-Semitism that are crashing across the country are the result of his political enemies staging events to make him look bad. I mean, that's a kind of incompetence in terms of optics that everybody should be really, really worried about. I mean, it's a no-brainer for a president to say, this is wrong and it has to stop. Yet he's not saying that. You know, he's saying, oh, these are my enemies trying to make me look foolish.
Well, I think he is behaving like something like a caged animal and perhaps even a guilty man. And I think that's to do with the fact that, one, he's incompetent, completely out of his depth, and perhaps he didn't, like everybody, didn't think he was going to make it and doesn't mm-hmm. quite know what to do the job, never really wanted the job. He's boosted his brand. That's what's happened. His sons are out there selling the Trump brand like crazy on the public mm-hmm. dime, by the way, in terms of their Secret Service protection. Yeah. And you've got this looming Russian scandal that he's doing everything he can to desperately plug up with this firewall that he's built with a political appointee to the CIA, a political appointee to the DNI, these two shills that he's got at the chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee and the House Intelligence Committee, right. All trying to keep the Russian story under wraps. But it's just too much of it out there from what I understand from my intel sources. So I think this is a scared, desperate man, one, out of his depth, and two, terrified that they're going to find out about the true scope and nature of his relationships to the Russians.
Well, yeah, I mean, he is now deeply enmeshed in the Washington swamp, right? And one aspect of Washington swamp is that public servants, when they feel like they're being ignored or even slandered, start to leak like crazy. And one of the sources of leaking that yet to arise is the IRS. I'm hoping that some patriot someplace in the IRS will find a way to send to the New York Times or the Washington Post Donald Trump's tax returns. I mean, it's there. There's a document someplace in the bureaucracy, waiting for waiting to be leaked, and it probably will depend on the level of heat that the president is under and the level of resistance. If he starts attacking, purging leakers the way that he appears to be doing, and if he's able to do it in any competent way, you're probably going to see. We haven't seen any kind of leaking yet. You know, we'll see even more, and that itself is hard to imagine.
Well, it's pretty clear that they're doing everything they can to shut down the Russian story, and they had Nunes just saying there's nothing there, and they will continue to do that. But my understanding is that they may just simply, it may just be a losing battle and a matter of time before the truth comes out, and it might well lead to impeachment. But in your article, John Storr, you talking about the Democrats' best play might be to highlight the Trump administration's incompetence, and you also point out that, for example, Daryl Issa, who's not too far from where I'm speaking, is in a district that could swing Democrat, and he's trying to cover his bets by calling for a inquiry. So that, I think, is a real vulnerability that they have. But on the other hand, how do you explain, I think it was like 23 Democratic senators voted for Wilbur Ross's appointment to Secretary of Commerce. Now, I know that's always been a job for rich guys and successful, and a lot of times it's just a dumping ground for political payoffs. But this guy is so dirty with the Cyprus bank that he co-owns with a Russian gangster. He's one of his partners is this Russian potash billionaire, the so-called fertilizer king, whose private Airbus was seen innumerable times on the same park right next to Trump's plane during the campaign. There's all kinds of investigations going on about those connections to the potash king and whether he's the liaison between Putin and Trump. And instead of calling for an inquiry into Wilbur Ross's holdings as, you know, as a co-owner of a money laundering operation, that's what these banks in Cyprus are. They money launder for the Russian oligarchs. They go ahead and vote for this guy. So what the hell's happening there?
Yeah, well, I mean, politicians are only what I teach my students at Yale is that, and I mean this in a sincere way, that politicians are a lot like pack mules, that they're only going to do what you want them to do, and if you make them do it. And in the case of Wilbur Ross, there aren't too many constituencies in the Democratic Party that care a lot about commerce. They did care a lot about education. They did care a lot about labor. They did care a lot about budgets and so on. But commerce is a kind of a fight that a lot of them, the constituencies of the Democratic Party, there's not a fight to be had there. I think in principle you're right. I'm just talking about the politics of it. There's just one fight that was just ignored, and they're moving on to another fight. It may be a missed opportunity. I think I would say you're right in that regard. But even so, now that he's in there, and if something comes to light, you know, it won't be the Democrats' commerce secretary. It will be Trump's commerce secretary.
Well, just in closing, since the State of the Union is coming up soon, John Storr, what do you expect? Are we going to? We know that Bannon is probably riding it along with this other fellow, Stephen Miller, who's, I think, even more rabid than Bannon is, and seems to be a complete sort of naive right-wing ideologue. And I can't imagine what kind of dialogue would come from Stephen Miller. But if it's Bannon, it's all about, you know, the world coming to an end and the apocalypse and carnage in the streets of America. He can't do that, can he, at this State of the Union? And I think if Trump ever goes off script, or if the Democrats, you know, sort of don't get up and cheer him, and which they won't, he's likely to make some remark, is he not, you know, in that petulant, childish way that he has.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Expect all of that and more is what I would suggest. Experience teaches us that for every major speech Donald Trump has made, he has delivered some variation of a dystopian hellscape, that life is horrible and only he will be the person to fix it all. I will be stunned if it's a rosy, optimistic, kumbaya moment, but I just, there's no reason to expect him to be conciliatory, to be friendly. I mean, he'll be charming in the way that Donald Trump can be charming, but it'll always be about him. And otherwise, I would expect darkness and gloom.
Well, but that's apparently who he is. He doesn't have friends. He doesn't have a sense of humor.
Right.
He a kind of a joke in person, apparently, and people are stunned. I don't know whether you read Ed Koch's letters that came out just out today in the New York Times about him. He's known him for years, you know. Thinks he's the biggest clown that ever came. I can't believe that anybody takes him seriously. But here he is, president of the United States. Go figure.
Yeah, and a lot of, as I say in my piece, you know, incompetence can be hugely dangerous. You know, even if these aren't, you know, competent fascists who want to destroy democracy, incompetence can be really dangerous. It's not to be anything to be taken lightly.
Well, John Storr, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you very much.
And again, I've been speaking with John Storr, who's a lecturer in political science at Yale University, a business columnist for Hearst Newspapers, an essayist for the New Haven Register, and a U.S. News and World Report contributing editor, where he has an article, Trump Can't Govern. The Democrats' best play might be to highlight the Trump administration's incompetence. We're going to take a brief station break, and we're back discussing the call for an investigation into the recent raid in Yemen by the father of the SEAL who died in the raid. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Robert Young Pelton, an author, filmmaker, journalist, and explorer. He is the publisher of Dangerous Magazine and has had a firsthand perspective on the war on terror from direct contact with the world's most infamous jihadi, rebel, and insurgent groups. His books include The World's Most Dangerous Places, Come Back Alive, Three Worlds Gone Mad, License to Kill, Hired Guns in the War on Terror, and his autobiography, The Adventurist. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Young Pelton.
Hi.
And what do you make of this sort of brewing, I don't know whether it's a scandal or what it is, vis-a-vis the SEALs raid in Yemen that took place shortly after Donald Trump became president, and it involved the death of a Navy SEAL, Ryan Owens. Initially, the first criticism of the raid actually came from Senator John McCain, who didn't think it was a great success. The White House said it was a huge success. And then they got mad at McCain. Trump sent some angry tweets McCain's way. But now the father of Ryan Owen is calling for an investigation. And in an interview with the Miami Herald this weekend, he said the White House should not, quote, hide behind my son's death to prevent an investigation. And that prompted President Trump to go on Fox News to say that, quoting the president, talking about the generals, they explained what they wanted to do, the generals, who are very respected. My generals are the most respected we've had in many decades, I believe, and they lost Ryan. So it sounds like the president is blaming the death of this SEAL on the military, and that's pretty unusual. Most of the times, the buck stops at the desk in the Oval Office, and this seems like a change.
Well, you have to remember that the military is planning these things, and people like JSOC and what they call SEAL Team 6 are spending an extraordinary amount of time putting together what they call targeting packages based on what they hope to achieve. So it is a high-risk operation. Now, under Obama, he went with a fairly low-risk profile for a lot of these raids.
So zones. What explains then, one of the criticisms has been that this raid was pushed forward too fast. That's what some of the Obama people that were involved with it said, that we weren't ready. And the accusation is that the Trump administration simply, you know, pushed it forward when in order to get some kind of, you know, bump in the news cycle. That's the suggestion, at least, that this was a, you know, an attempt to take another one story off the headlines and put another one on.
Yeah. I wouldn't agree with that. I would say that any package that's prepared, that's ready for a green light, has been well thought through by a number of people. And if it gets an approval from a president, then all he's doing is confirming the planning skills of the people that work for him.
So what is then going on here with the father basically calling for an investigation and Senator McCain questioning whether the raid was such a great success, and then the president getting angry at McCain, and now the father getting angry at the administration, and now the president sort of blaming it on the generals for the death of Ryan Owens. So where will this ever lead to an investigation? Because NBC are reporting, NBC News are reporting, it wasn't a great success. The intelligence that they got from this raid was minimal at best.
Well, so once again, this is part of an accelerated program where you're now putting people at risk on the ground, going into a compound, more guns than any other country on earth, and you're going to have casualties and you're going to have secondary effects like the Osprey that crashed. The investigation, there's always an after-action report. The military always looks at what happened, you know, if something went wrong, what caused it. But this is the penalty of doing these kind of raids in a foreign country. I don't see anything wrong with them. If it becomes politicized, then I think what you end up doing is going right back to the Obama administration, where he kept everything at a very low profile and low risk.
So what was, as far as you know, then the objective here? Because as far as I know, somehow they got detected, and then there was a huge firefight. And then they ordered in air support, and the building from which all the fire was coming was bombed. And it was only then that they went in into the rubble and presumably got some laptops and things out of the rubble. Is that the line of events here?
Yeah, so you have a compound which is owned by Abdulrauf al-Dahab, and he's a very high-level target. So he is someone they either want to kill or capture, but they also are going on the ground because they want to either capture people for interrogation, or they want to get, like you say, the laptops, cell phones, data that's available. When you go into these compounds in the middle of the night, yes, they shoot back. You know, there's dogs barking, there's guards, et cetera, et cetera. And this is not the first time this has happened, by the way. So once that fighting starts, usually what they do is they call in air support to neutralize the fighting so they can operate at night. They can see where the gunfire is coming from. But in these houses are women and children. So there will be civilian casualties. There's actually ratios for how many civilians can die for each high-value target. So I'm assuming since he was a high-value target, they were willing to take out women and children to get at him. The fact that one of our men died is part of the risk that you take when you launch into these foreign countries. And there's a history of SEAL raids, of special forces raids, where people get killed. It was quite common in Iraq, and it continues to be quite common. But like I said, this is not a scandal or a disaster. This is something where a high-risk mission was greenlit by the commander-in-chief, when in fact it had not been greenlit. And this mission was planned since early 2006.
And again, I'm speaking with Robert Young Pelton, an author, filmmaker, journalist, and explorer. He's the publisher of Dangerous Magazine and has had firsthand perspective on the war on terror from direct contact with the world's most infamous jihadi, rebel, and insurgent groups. And his books include The World's Most Dangerous Places, Come Back Alive, Three Worlds Gone Mad, License to Kill, Hired Guns, and the War on Terror, and his autobiography, The Adventurist. But they didn't get the high-value target, right? And the question would be that after you bombed a place, what is the condition for the so-called intelligence, the laptops, et cetera? Because the impression that was given initially was that the SEALs got shot up, but they managed to get somehow neutralize the people that were shooting them and get a bunch of valuable intelligence. But as far as I know, the reason that the people in the building stopped firing at them was that they got bombed. And therefore, mm-hmm. the intelligence, the pieces, the laptops and stuff would have been bombed too. So what did they get? What condition was this intelligence in when they got it?
Well, I don't know because I wasn't other raids where they've literally flattened houses like in the head of Al-Qaeda in Iraq. They still can retrieve laptops. They can still receive information from cell phones, and they exploit it immediately, and they usually launch other raids within 24 or 48 hours. So they have to keep trying and trying and trying. So if they come up dry, typically in places like Iraq, you just keep going in, and you keep pulling apart networks until you found the information you were looking for. The real question is, are we willing to enter a high-risk period in which men and women get killed in these raids in order to defeat Al-Qaeda, ISIS, et cetera, or do we go back to drone strikes, which are fairly surgical but also kill women and children? It's just that there's no media there to write about it.
But the target himself, right, did get away, or he wasn't there. Is that what we understand?
Yeah, so typically once you're triggered, I mean, I've done missions with special forces, and they know when we're coming in because they can actually hear the drones. So when people know what's going on, they either head out via tunnel, and then when the fighting starts, it's just the fighters left behind. So it's very, very common not to find the person you're looking for, and it's also very, very common to find casualties because these houses are packed, and when you bring in an airship or bomb something, they collapse on the people inside, and it's not pretty, and it's have to keep doing it until they actually run this person down or find the information that leads to his termination. But this is the war we're fighting, and now we just saw it. That's the difference.
But I take it, though, that some of the collateral damage for the people that died in there were relatives of Al-Awlaki, and he has been the subject of a number of raids, one that killed him and then his son, I believe. And didn't another relative get killed in this raid?
Yeah, this is an 8-year-old child that is related. And the sad thing is that these families are actually related to Al-Awlaki, and this whole strain of Al-Qaeda, this guy insisted that there's no real proof that he is associated with Al-Qaeda members. Once again, this is what happens when you go into people's homes, and they're essentially compounds with multiple families living in these homes. And when you go in at night, they're all sleeping together, you know, in the women's quarters, and then they have the men's quarters. And typically these raids take place at about 3 o'clock or 3:30 in the morning, and they're usually discovered, and there's usually gunfire, and then they bring in either AC-130 gunships or they bring in other like jets or fast movers to take out the people that are shooting. So in this case, it was a mess. It was nothing really gained, and a lot of people died. And this is what turns people against us, because the locals see this basic slaughter of women and children without understanding why we did it.
And, of course, the Osprey that was it was actually bombed by a Marine Harrier jet, I understand. And that's a $75 million price tag, is it not?
Yeah, that's your tax dollars at work. It was bombed after it crashed, though, so that basically they want to take out the electronics and the Elint stuff that's aboard that plane, and that's fairly typical. And once again, you have to remember, we're fighting these remote wars. They're very, very expensive to fight. You can imagine if they were planning this mission for almost a year, and they were using all these aircraft and intelligence sources, whatever. This is a very expensive raid. And when the commander in chief, and of course JSOC and people like that, to decide whether that's worth the risk. And that's why we've been using drones, because with a drone, we have persistent surveillance. We wait till they're in a convoy where they have the lowest number of collateral casualties, which are women and children, of course, and civilians. And then we usually kill them with a $1 million missile. And then that's very clean, and it doesn't hit the headlines until we do a press release. Going in on the ground to grab people and to grab information does end up killing people. Now, it's interesting, there was also UAE commandos here, and we typically, and we use these special operations people as advisors, so they're not as close to the fighting. So we slightly went a little bit more aggressive on this, and one of our Navy SEALs got killed.
And what role did the special forces from the UAE, the United Arab Emirates, play? Do you know?
Well, they speak Arabic, which sounds silly, but I mean, that's why we do joint missions, and we train them, we equip them. They're very good, and we do joint missions with them, just like we use Iraqis and Afghans. When I was in Afghanistan, we did missions with Afghan commandos, Afghan special forces, and they're very good. They're very aggressive, and what happens is that all the aircraft that flies overhead, and there's quite a bit of aircraft flying overhead, is coordinated by the Americans and comes in to support people when they get, you know, locked down in a gunfight. So these are very complex, expensive missions, and we're trying to get our partners to do them. And don't forget, we're also working with Saudi Arabia and other members. And sometimes it works well and sometimes it isn't. In this case, we did not get the person, and I say we, I mean America did not get the person they were trying to get. And there's some doubt as to whether this person should have been the person we were getting, which is probably why President Obama did not approve the raid, because he didn't feel the risk was worth it.
So what do you think Senator McCain was saying when he first contradicted the White House Press Secretary, Sean Spicer, who said it was a great success, which then in turn prompted President Trump to send some angry tweets at McCain? Was he getting, I mean, he's the chair of the Armed Services Committee, right? So presumably he's getting information from the Pentagon.
Yeah, so this isn't a Western gunfight where we shoot the bad guy and we're done. This is network-centric warfare. So we have a big map, you know, of who's who and who reports to who. And this is like the infamous number two that always dies. So what we have to do is dissect that network by taking out each part of the network until it collapses. So this is a very long-term war, and this mission was probably a key part of taking out this gentleman and his organization. He only had 800 men, but if they could neutralize this person, then Al-Qaeda would have less support in that region. And when you say a raid is a success or a failure, sometimes just reaching out to people in the middle of the night when they think they aren't going to get attacked, because don't forget, we haven't done a raid in a very, very long time on the ground, can disturb that network.
So
effects. So secondary effects are seeing who's talking on the phone, who's listening in, so that we could find out who's linked to this organization.
Well, but what was released by the Pentagon under the claim that this was the valuable intelligence that was found at this house that was bombed was an old video that was available online. So do you have any right. information as to whether they actually got something valuable out of this raid?
Well, they would get SIGINT, and SIGINT is basically signals intelligence, so they would have things like phone numbers and communications, but I don't know why the Trump administration decided that was or actually it was the military, but I don't know why they thought that was great intel, because it wasn't. It was a very old film. This was not a successful raid. It was, if the goal of the raid was to capture the main person, then that didn't happen. If they downgraded to saying, well, we just wanted to disturb the network and we wanted to gather some material on site, then you can say, fine, it's a success. If a Navy SEAL had not been killed doing this, I don't even know that we wouldn't hear about it. You know, if a person suddenly died in the middle of Yemen, would we even hear about it? So it destroys the fabric that special operations creates, which is sort of being mysterious and all powerful to pull this into the public. And it also cautions politicians and Trump administration, and that people do die in raids. And I've had friends die in these raids. And at the end of the day, they seem kind of pointless, because there are so many people that can be raided or arrested or killed or shot. And this is a very violent, expensive way to do it.
And how does this relate to the bigger counterinsurgency operation underway against the Islamic State in Iraq and in Syria? Mosul seems to be gradually falling to the Iraqi government, and there are, I think, a fairly substantial U.S. presence there, and they're giving support. And then you've got this other situation in Raqqa, which is the capital of the Islamic State in Syria, and the U.S. have been using the Kurdish Peshmerga that the Turks are not very happy about. They've put together their own so-called Arab army, which is rather dubious. So let's start with Iraq.
Iraq, we have a mess. In Iraq, we have a mess because we pulled out and the Shias took over. And then the answer to the Shia dominance was to create ISIS, and now we're dealing with that. But we still haven't fixed Iraq, and it doesn't matter if we get rid of ISIS, it still doesn't fix Iraq. In Syria, I don't think we're ever going to fix Syria. It's up to Syria to do that. And the elimination of ISIS, once again, does not change the problems in Syria, which, as you remember, started with people rising up against Assad. I was just watching them kill ISIS. And once again, getting rid of ISIS in Libya doesn't solve the problems in ISIS. So I would like to think that we should step back and say, you know, are we doing an international war on terror against regional insurgents, or are we actually, you know, cleaning up areas that threaten the United States?
So what is the likelihood in, I mean, there's some talk now that the Trump administration is going to try and work out a deal with the Russians in Syria and sort of, you know, basically accede to their war plan. As far as I can tell, the Russians are just sort of indiscriminately killing people in support of the Assad regime, and they haven't really concentrated their firepower on ISIS. They've been going after the proxies that the U.S. has developed, the so-called Free Syrian Army, or what's left of it.
Right. Well, I was in Grozny in Chechnya in 1999 watching Putin's tactics, and basically he kills everybody, removes all the support for the rebels, and then kills all the rebels. So he has a very different tactic. This is not surgical at all, but this is something that Assad did not have. He did not have constant violent raids on civilians and destroying infrastructure. But once again, this has got nothing to do with ISIS. ISIS just exists because there's a lack of governance. You know, there's nobody to kick them out, and they kind of grow like a fungus. What I feel is going to happen is that I think the Trump administration is going to get involved in a war with Iran, which would then make all these tiny wars sort of disappear. And we, you know, I've heard the administration say they're going to get rid of ISIS in 30 days. Well, I don't think that's going to happen. But if people suddenly focused on a bigger war, I don't know that we would even pay attention to ISIS anymore.
Right. But isn't that pretty extraordinary to think that there's no historical memory here? Remember what going to, you know, a military action against Iran did for Jimmy Carter. It ended his presidency. A military action or intelligence operation involving Iran, called the Iran-Contra affair, almost brought down Ronald Reagan. If you actually have a shooting war with the Iranians, say in the Straits of Hormuz, that would probably close off the oil coming out of the Gulf and raise the price of oil astronomically. And again, I don't understand, you know, are they that sort of cocky? I know there's a lot of people in that administration, including Mattis himself, who want to go, and I believe McMaster also wants to go after Iran. So I take your warning with great seriousness. But on the other hand, can you answer that question of why don't people, are they not cognizant of how if you kick that hornet's nest known as Iran, you're going to have hell on your hands?
Well, you got to remember that we were going to invade or at least bomb Iran when we went into Iraq. In other words, it was the next domino. And our military is actually designed to go up against armies like Iran. Now, we can't deal with Hezbollah, and we can't deal with sort of these ground like the Houthis, these sort of proxies. But in a strange way, the U.S. military is better designed to go in and, let's say, overthrow or shut down a government like we did in that. Than we are in these long-term counterterrorism operations. And yes, it's insane to think that might happen, but it was also insane to think that we were going to invade Iraq.
Well, again, that raises questions about historical memory. And why would an invasion of Iran work out any better than an invasion of Iraq? When you invade a country, don't you get the people to rally around the flag? And even the Iranian people, who I believe the majority do not like this government and would probably be happy to see it go, if push came to shove, they'd fight the Americans because they were invaders.
Right. So in the ground war in Iran, what we're looking at is full deployment of Air Force, Navy assets, and then creation of a sort of, back to the Arab uprising theme, And once again, I'm not a war planner. I've just been in these wars watching them. And it just seems that the U.S. military is structured better to handle large-scale invasions and attacks, because we've been locked into Afghanistan and Iraq and places like that for many, many years without any solutions to get us out. Whereas if you go back to the George Bush senior days, when we could go in, you know, smack a dictator around and pull all our troops out, that was considered the pinnacle of American military power.
Right, but how do you deal with, or what would the collateral damage be in terms of, for example, my understanding is the Iranians, the IRGC, the Revolutionary Guard Corps, have plans to shut down the Straits of Hormuz, to bomb all of the Saudi oil installations. The price of oil would go through the roof. Obviously, Putin would be very happy with this. And Putin is supposedly an Iranian ally. So this, I'm trying to get a broader geopolitical picture here of the consequences.
Well, I see Donald Trump as someone who's used to kicking somebody off of balance and dealing with the consequences in real time. This is a business tactic. I also see that there's been longstanding pointing at the Shia-Sunni divide and that one of the reasons for the split. And you got to remember that when you watch the videos of the Houthis, who are Shia, fighting in Yemen against the Saudis, they're yelling death to Israel, death to America. They're not yelling death to Saudi Arabia.
I see.
IE or America.
Right.
So you're looking at a very different war.
But you think it's coming, a war with Iran.
I think it's coming. And once again, it was going to happen in around 2006, because I sat in meetings in which commanders were told, don't forget to insert this bit of bad news about Iran killing soldiers in Iraq. Don't forget to insert, you know, how Iran's supporting the Taliban. And Dick Cheney was hot to major offensive against Iran.
Well, Robert Young Pelton, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
It's always a pleasure, Ian.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Robert Young Pelton, who's an author, filmmaker, journalist, and explorer. He's the publisher of Dangerous Magazine and has had firsthand perspective on the war on terror from direct contact with the world's most infamous jihadi, rebel, and insurgent groups. And his books include The World's Most Dangerous Places, Come Back Alive, Three Worlds Gone Mad, License to Kill, Hired Guns in the War on Terror, and his autobiography, The Adventurist. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Bye.